This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. You've been reading about the scandal surrounding the administration of Chris Christie in New Jersey, about how top aide orchestrated a traffic jam in Fort Lee as political payback. Well, the agency involved was the Port Authority, which runs the George Washington Bridge, and the authority is what's called a quasi-public agency. What are some other examples? Well, there's the U.S. Postal Service, and you know the problems they've been having. There's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Well, moving on. There's the MTA, which has been in the news after a high-speed crash of a Hudson Line commuter train. At the state level, there are 11 such agencies, like, for instance, the CRRA, the trash authority that has, well, recently come under fire for six-figure salaries. On the local level, one example of a quasi-public is the old New London Development Corporation, which orchestrated the Fort Trumbull development, which led to the Kelo versus New London Supreme Court case. Perhaps these are bad examples. It's true quasi-publics are getting a pretty bad rap these days. Today, Where We Live, a look inside the world of the quasi-public agency. What exactly is it? How does it run? How much oversight do we have over it? And most importantly, does it work better than using a private company or a truly public department to do the same kind of work? Join us with your thoughts and your questions, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. Coming up, we'll talk with the head of one quasi-public, Connecticut Innovations. But I want to welcome in State Comptroller Kevin Lembo to our studio. We're also joined by the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. And Comptroller, good to see you again. Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us here on Where We Live.
Happy New Year, John. It's good to be here.
So in Connecticut, what constitutes a quasi-public?
Well, we've got about 11 or 12, as you point out, quasi-governmental agencies. They are defined in statute, and I think they defy sweeping generalizations on their structure or their goals. And most folks, as you point out, think of CRRA or think of executive compensation and start to wonder what that's all about. I think the thing that they share in common is that they are designed to perform a function related to government, but a function that is outside of either the experience or the regular operation of government, but it does have a public touch to it.
It has a public touch to it. Why isn't it just a public agency?
Well, there's lots of reasons. Some would argue that because of the nature of some of the quasis, they need to be more nimble, able to be free of some administrative burdens that state agencies are under, or that they need to attract people with certain subsets of experience that either don't exist within government or that government can't afford in the regular structure of government administration.
When you talk about administrative burdens, I assume that one of those burdens that perhaps a quasi-public wouldn't have that a state department would have is that state departments have employees who are state employees and are paid by state employee contract. Quasi-publics don't fall under the same category.
That's right. Generally, that is true. They often have their own employment contracts with their employees. But for every one of the 12, they have a slightly different makeup. They they have to follow certain state rules. Others don't. Some are in the state health plan. Some are not. Some are in the pension plan or not, in both or neither.
And how does that get determined? Does the legislature write up rules around each specific quasi-public, and how does that come about?
Pretty much. So the case is made that we need a quasi to perform a certain function, or we want to transfer, like in the case of the Airport Authority, a certain function that government is performing over to a quasi. Then they get added to Section 1-120, which is the list of the quasis. But then after that, the construction of them are unique to their section of the law. So what may be required of the state lottery, for example, may not be required of Connecticut Innovations. They do very different things and have different requirements.
And we'll be hearing about Connecticut Innovations in just a bit. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266 with questions and thoughts about quasis, as Kevin Lembo is calling them. We're cutting off the agency altogether. We're shortening it to quasis today on the program. You can join us again, 860-275-7266. Let me bring in Gail Radford, who's Associate Professor of History at the State University of New York at Buffalo, author of The Rise of the Public Authority, State Building and Economic Development in 20th Century America. Gail, welcome to our program. Thanks so much.
Thank you for asking me.
So give us some of the history of these authorities. How far back does this idea date?
It goes back to the early 20th century. Activists, politicians, and public officials who were anxious to build things and do things, started experimenting with new mechanisms by which they could take action to do things like build modern sewer systems for cities or expand a public park system. And a lot of the there's an idea that comes up in the literature a lot that a number of these reformers who developed the early models were anxious to create something that was that would insulate them from public accountability, partially just reasoning back from the way they worked out. But when I went back as a historian of the early 20th century and I looked at the historical evidence, it turns out that these folks weren't really conspiratorial. They weren't all that ideological. They were simply practical, and they were trying to find ways for government to be more active in the economy.
Mm. An early example is one that many of our listeners may know about. It's the Tennessee Valley Authority. Talk about that, this early quasi-governmental agency in the 1930s, how it was formed and what it did.
Well, it was set up to generate low-cost energy and do economic development in the South. And it was established as what's technically called a government-owned corporation. And the reason that it was set up in that form, rather than just being a straight government agency, is that the folks who designed it wanted it to be able to engage flexibly in the market, because you can't sue government agencies. They have various rules for buying things and hiring, the kinds of things that the controller just mentioned. So they wanted to have a mechanism that could be more nimble and more independent.
So I just want to go back to Kevin Limbo here. When we talk about nimble and independent, flexibility in the marketplace, these may sound like very good ideals to try to get a specific thing done. Where I sit on the media side of things, where transparency in government is very, very important, these all seem like code words for getting things done that the rest of the world doesn't really need to look at so much. Gales, you know, is very specific in saying that historically, the Tennessee Valley Authority and other early quasi-publics weren't really set up to be non-transparent, but that has grown out of the system in many ways. Maybe you can talk about that, about how much we're supposed to know about the quasi-publics that are operating in Connecticut.
Well, I think, you know, it's a common misconception that the quasis are somehow free of freedom of information, for example. They are subject to FOI. But it's what happens once you file your FOI, or even if you know you should, right? So it's not necessarily the sort of the existence of the law. It's how we operate within the spirit of that law. And I would say in recent years, there is a positive movement towards greater transparency, not only within Connecticut government, which has been sort of behind a cloak for a very long time, but also with the quasi-governmental agencies. Look, if the folks at these agencies feel like they are protected from scrutiny, they are incorrect. If in the case of Connecticut Innovations and some others, if they pass a two-prong GASB Government Accounting Standards Board test, and that is that the board is sort of government controlled, so the government and the legislature appoint the board members, and that the state has some sort of financial stake in the life of that quasi-governmental agency, or we serve as a backstop, you know, for their risk, then they have to have outside independent auditors come in and go through their statements. They have to publish them. They have to share them according to state law. And we include them in our GASB report that includes state government financing. But it's that spirit of the law piece. And I think that's really the space in which we need to improve the way we do business.
So, Gail Radford, it seems as though in Connecticut there are a number of different ways in which quasi-publics are run. Each one has a slightly different set of rules. I assume that also means that in every state, quasi-publics are run slightly differently than in Connecticut. So maybe you can just quickly flesh that out for us. How does each state determine what's going to be a quasi-government function and what's actually just going to be handled by government or private business?
Well, there's a lot of randomness involved. They operate all throughout the country at all levels of government. Many of them are huge, things like the TVA we talked about. In 2011, it posted revenues of $12 billion. You've been talking about the state-level quasis in Connecticut. A big state-level quasi in New Jersey is the Sports and Exposition Authority. It owns and operates $1 billion worth of facilities. But in fact, most quasis are small to medium-sized organizations. They run a single operation. Probably all of us have parked our car at one time or another in a garage or a lot that's run by a parking authority that was set up by a city or a town. They're very different from one another. Even within individual states, there's not a single name for them. The one that most people are familiar with is public authorities. And that's why I use that for, in the title of my book, so that people would have an idea of what I was talking about. But in fact, what the terminology that you're using on this show and that seems to be standard in Connecticut is superior, I think, because a lot of them, they don't say authority in their name. They don't say they say a lot of things. But let me just say that the key defining feature of these things is that they're independent. They're created by governments to do things that are defined as being in the public interest. But they're then independent from government that create them. They're independent administratively and financially.
And so, Kevin Lemo, in Connecticut, flesh that out a little bit more for us. Independent administratively, how do the heads of these quasi-publics get chosen? How do we determine how much they're going to get paid? How much the state is going to invest in these quasi-publics?
So, again, different from one to another. More often than not, the boards of directors make decisions. The boards of directors of most of our quasis are appointed by government, both from the legislative and the executive branch. And then the boards make decision on who the executive team will be and often make decisions about what their compensation package is, what any bonuses may look like, you know, based on performance. But many of them also have bonding authority, or the state will bond on their behalf to raise the capital to do the work. And in some cases, they have to pay that bond back, and in other cases, they don't. It really depends on the quasi. But in those that we, the state, have an interest in them maintaining a certain level of reserves, for example, those are that group that fall under that GASB definition I gave earlier. We watch their balance sheet, and in some cases, we've seen some of them go upside down, and the state has had to step in to right the ship and get things back going in the right direction. Now, by Dr. Radford's definition, maybe we should have stood outside of that and let them go upside down. And I don't know, you know, where independence, right, where should we stop? Because we do have deep investments in every one of these organizations.
And we'll be talking about some of those investments and also bringing in one of the heads of one of the quasi-publics in a moment. We want to get to a few of your phone calls, 860-275-7266. We have Ryan calling from Enfield. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. Ryan, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I sure can. You're on the air. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm curious why the CRRA, the Connecticut Resource Recovery Authority, still exists. This agency has privatized away most of its function, and it's been a management disaster. It used to run like four trash-to-energy plants. Now it runs none, and it used to run a landfill that's since been closed. John Lender did a piece about how excessive the salaries are. It seems that nobody's minding the store as far as the existence of this agency that doesn't have a function anymore is concerned.
Oh, Ryan, thank you. Kevin Lembo, one of the things we talked about at the top of the show, the CRRA, the Connecticut Resources Recovery Authority, has come under a lot of fire for some of the things Ryan just talked about, including just recently.
Right. So CRRA, when it was created, was seen as cutting edge, turning trash to energy. It was a time, I believe, in the 70s where we were having both a problem with what to do with our trash and, you know, the cost of energy. And the thing about quasis is they are created to address an issue, a problem in the here and now. And it is absolutely possible, likely, that some of them will unwind as their usefulness disappears. Ryan is right. You know, the change in the mission of CRRA is clear. They came back, I believe, to the legislature last year and asked for different consideration and credits for the energy that they were producing. That was turned back, and the deep Commissioner Estee came out in opposition to their plan. But between the compensations and the business model, that may not be necessary anymore. This may be something over the next couple of years that you see start to go away.
But how do you unwind something like this, something that is so massive, that has had so much state investment and is so much a part of everyday life in Connecticut? How do you begin to unwind something and say maybe there's a different, better way?
Well, it's almost the opposite of what needs to happen before you set it up in the first place, right? So there needs to be a real analysis before we open one of these quasis or create them statutorily, that there is a need. And a need that can't be met in the existing marketplace and by someone else, that it's going to have a real impact on the problem that we've identified, and that there is, in most cases, going to be some sort of return on investment at a minimum that will lead to self-sustainability. When that changes, then you need to sort of back up and re-examine whether the need still exists and if it's still having an impact, and does it have an ROI? And if the answer to those are no to the ROI, no to the impact, and you know there is somebody else who can do it, then we need to figure out who that is. They are not necessarily forever, just like the rest of us.
That's a very good way to put it. We're going to take a break quickly. When we come back, we'll talk more with Kevin Lembo, the state controller. Also, Gail Radford is here from the University of Buffalo. She's written about quasi-public agencies or public authorities as well. When we come back, we'll be talking with the head of Connecticut Innovations, one of the state quasi-public agencies. We're going to take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The U.S. Postal Service is a quasi-public agency. So is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We're trying to figure out what a quasi-public is here in Connecticut. There's a lot of questions about them, about how they're run, about whether or not they're the most efficient way to do the state's business. You can join us at 860-275-7266. State Comptroller Kevin Lembo keeps an eye on all this stuff. He joins us in studio today. We also have on the line Gail Radford from the University of Buffalo, who's written a book called The Rise of the Public Authority, State Building and Economic Development in 20th Century America. More of your phone calls in just a moment, but I want to bring in Claire Leonardi, who's CEO of Connecticut Innovations Incorporated, one of the 11 or 12 quasi-publics in the state. Claire, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So explain what Connecticut Innovations does, first of all.
Well, I want to echo what both Kevin and Gail have talked about, that we are a public entity, but we really function like a private business. We are investors. Our goal is economic development. And we look at the state kind of, you know, for your listeners, we look at the state as really our shareholders. Everyone who lives in the state has a stake in what Connecticut Innovations does, and our objective is to grow the economy. But we have a fiduciary responsibility to the state to deliver on what the purpose of what CI does. And so what we do is we make equity investments, and we also make loans. Our equity investments are typically in high-tech companies. We are a venture capital fund. We partner heavily with the private sector. And on the lending side, we partner with banks, and so that we can increase the amount of money that goes to our company. So our overall objective is to help companies start and grow in the state of Connecticut.
So let's just get to the reason why Connecticut Innovations works well, in your mind, as a quasi-public as opposed to a private entity or a governmental agency. There's plenty of private equity firms in Connecticut, venture capital firms. Certainly, we probably have more than an awful lot of states. The Treasurer's Office is an example of a state agency that makes investments on behalf of the state, just as an example. So why does CI need to exist in your mind as a quasi-public that's sort of in between these two things?
Well, we do operate like a private enterprise. What we do is we look at the marketplace and we try to fill gaps that the private sector does not fill. We do not want to overlap or take the place of private sector dollars. And so when we go into the marketplace, what we do is very early stage investments. It's very hard in this country, it's not just Connecticut, to get adequate early stage investments. And so these are companies that are just starting, they're pre-revenue, they're very risky. We are actually one of the most active early stage investors in the country, not just Connecticut. And so we invest about $20 to $25 million a year. And it's all over the it's we have difficulty aligning up private capital. The Treasurer does invest in venture capital funds. A lot of them are not early stage. We think that the Treasurer is doing a good job. I mean, the Treasurer's job is to get return on that investment, but we are in a very risky sector. But we do a good job. We do earn money for the state over time. Since our inception, we've had a 17% internal rate of return on our investments. So it's profitable, but we need to find more capital to come to the state.
Kevin Limbo, maybe you can give me your take on this. I guess what I'm trying to get at is with all of the private investment that's out there, it seems as though the state could rely on private firms in some way. They could have a different governmental agency to make this. Do you think that the way that, say, Connecticut Innovations is constructed makes the most possible sense in terms of return on investment, which you talked about before, for the state of Connecticut?
Yeah, and I think even before return on investment, that need piece in the calculus, why do we need this? There is a need. When I was reviewing the financial statements coming out of Connecticut Innovations in anticipation of today, you know, they have multiple programs, and there was one that was very predictably called Seed, and then one that was called Pre-Seed, which sort of got my attention, because that, I think, and Claire can correct me, that, you know, that's the place where, you know, there are good ideas all over the state that need that sort of early lift that they're just not going to get through those sort of big, almost white shoe capital firms. And so there is a place for us. And if we want to be in that place, if we want to give those little companies the lift to see if their idea is going to test and test well, then this is probably the best way to do it.
So a question that I think a lot of people would have is you're running as a private entity, but because you're doing it on behalf of the state, what part of the state are you doing it on behalf of? Many different people in the state, whether it's the governor's office or people in the state legislature or mayors of towns and cities, might have very different ideas about where you should be putting your dollars. As someone investing our money, who are you listening to?
Well, we have a very rigorous process to analyze. I mean, Connecticut's a small state. I mean, we're about the size of Silicon Valley. So people look at us and say, well, should you invest in New Haven? Should you invest in Hartford? We invest in the best ideas in the state. We have a lot of partners. We partner with the universities and things like that. But we look at probably 700 ideas a year. And, you know, the teams come in, they talk to us, we analyze their technology, we peer review it. So we really are acting truly like a private sector firm.
We talked in the first segment about some of the requirements that you might have to do as far as reporting, some of the ways in which you need to be transparent to the public that you're working for. Tell us about that. What do you have to do that maybe a private company that invests in the same way wouldn't have to do in terms of disclosure and information?
Well, we do a lot of the same things. As Kevin said, we do have independent auditors. We post our financial statements on our website. You can see all of the companies that we've invested in. You can see where they reside, what they do. So that part of the transparency, to me, that's positive because I think that builds support because you can see the very fine and exciting companies that we invest in. There is also a myriad of state reporting that we need to do. Some of that I think is useful. Some of it I'm not sure actually enhances what you understand about us, but we are very open. We are subject to FOI, but we do protect proprietary information on behalf of the companies that apply to us.
When you say proprietary information, give us an example of what that would be.
Well, it would be intellectual property. So if a company comes to us with a new idea, say it's a proprietary algorithm that analyzes sensors or things like that, we are not required to disclose that because that is a business asset. But we are required to disclose who they are, how much they're asking for, those kind of things. So we are not required to disclose anything that would endanger the business of the applicant.
Well, one of the things that Kevin Lumber, you've been pushing for is more transparency in government. I'll just give an example here. We talk about proprietary things. One of the quasi-publics is a fairly new one. It's Access Health CT. They're running the state exchanges
right
under the new healthcare law. We've had a little bit of a FOIA fight here at WNPR with them about a little piece of information because they see it as proprietary how much per minute their call centers are charging the state for the work that they're doing. It's seen by the call center itself as proprietary information. They don't want to give this up because they don't want to give information to their competitors. That said, the state of Connecticut is paying for that service. Shouldn't we know how much we're going to be on the hook for this organization that we've outsourced our call centers to? That's a piece of proprietary information in one world. In our world, we're looking at it like, don't we need to know how much we're paying for this?
Right. So I think it's one of the issues that has popped up in state government over the years without speaking directly to the merits of that, because I would lean, you're not going to be surprised, toward disclosure on something like that. But I don't think it's the role of either a state government, an agency head, or a quasi-governmental head, except for the very obvious, as Claire has laid out, you know, the deep sort of calculations and, you know, that's clearly unique and proprietary to those companies. But when it comes to sort of larger contracts that we pay out to do administrative work and other services related, I think it's the job of the executive of the agency to default to disclosure and let the company make their case for why it is proprietary or it should not be released. So my responsibility now, you know, I buy healthcare. Right. So my responsibility now is if you FOI stuff related to the healthcare purchasing, I lean toward disclosure. I alert the companies that this is what we're about to do, and they are a party to this, right? So they get to sort of object or raise concern. And also, once they do, I can't accept that at face value. I think it's my job on behalf of the citizen to push on that a little bit, to really find what is proprietary and what is not, because it's easy to sort of default to, well, whatever the company said is proprietary. I think we have a responsibility to the taxpayer to push on that a little bit. And ultimately, the arbiter of that is going to be the FOI Commission. So, you know, the company will have to go there, in your example, and defend their representation that that's proprietary. And then the agency, or in this case the quasi-governmental agency, the exchange, will have to make a decision about whether it wants to sit at their table or at the FOI table. And, you know, you learn a lot. We've been through this. You'll remember with the cardiac care in Medicaid, you know, we were sure that, you know, folks were not – this is 10 years ago now – that they weren't getting access to cardiologists in Medicaid because the reimbursement was so low, and then we weren't able to find out what the reimbursement was. Well, that was just kind of nuts, and it took a long time to get through it, and we did ultimately, and it's precedent setting.
We're talking with Kevin Lembo about quasi-public agencies in the state. Also joining us today in studio is Claire Leonardi, who's CEO of Connecticut Innovations, one of the quasis, as we're calling them. In just a moment, I've got more from Gail Radford at the University of Buffalo, and we'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. Getting back to something that one of our callers raised just a moment ago, though, Claire, this is another piece of the transparency. So you run as a private company that is run on behalf of the state, but you're running, you know, a different set of figures for salaries, for instance. The CRRA has come under fire for having higher salaries than many people think a public agency should have. Talk about that balance for a moment, because when you're running as a private company and all your books are out there for everyone to see and people feel like my tax dollars are at work here, talk about that calculus of how you hire people for, you know, very big salaries when, you know, in many cases, you're a public agency.
Well, you have to look at what it takes to do the work that we do. I mean, it's a very specialized job, but it is a balance. You're absolutely right. We can't pay like the private sector, but we want to demand private sector performance. And so if you're in the marketplace and you're looking, particularly if you're looking to partner with the private sector, they want to be sitting across the table from somebody that has a lot to offer. We don't just make investments. We work with companies. So we're really asking our people to do exactly what they would do in a private sector firm. All of our folks are very committed to the economic development side. So you need to really find that kind of person that wants to be part of really what's like a social enterprise. You know, it's profit with a purpose. So we've got a very special group of people. But it is a balance. You're absolutely right.
We got a tweet from Joe to this end. He writes, like with Wall Street and other industries, I'm tired of Quasi's excuse of, quote, needing to recruit a certain type of person, unquote, which translates into paying a ridiculously high salary. This is a tweet from Joe. Kevin Lembo, we mentioned this earlier. So give me your take on this. I mean, it's a public agency, but it's not a public agency. Joe and many others say this whole idea of you have to find a certain type of person doesn't sit particularly well.
But I think it's true. You know, look, there's a lot about this that makes a lot of us uncomfortable, right? It feels a little like I'm not quite sure what this is. Is it in? Is it out? Let's acknowledge that the quasi-governmental agencies enjoy a privileged place in that they're just far enough out from government that they have some latitude to do things, but they get some of the benefit of being, you know, having the full faith and credit of the state often behind them. That's a privileged place to be. I mean, it would be great to be able to recruit folks to work in some of these agencies that are coming directly off the floor, you know, working in a private company. But this has a public interest. You know, this is, as Claire pointed out, and I'm delighted that she understands that the constituency, the shareholders, are the taxpayers of the state. I would also argue that that has not been a pervasive opinion at the quasi-governmental agencies over the years, and therefore there's a certain level of suspicion about them. To the earlier point, you can solve and cure a lot of that suspicion through greater transparency, putting the information out there that is not proprietary or is not dangerous to companies that are working with us, but just to let people know in an easy-to-understand way what you're up to, what it costs, and what we're getting back in the process.
Well, and that last thing before we go to our next phone caller, that return on investment, if the quasi-government agency is working and getting the state what they need, people have a much easier time swallowing high salaries or less transparency than anything else, because if it's working, it's a good thing. It's the problem, Claire, that people see is if it's not working, then they start raising questions.
My opinion, if it's not working, we shouldn't be here. I mean, part of what we do every day is look at all the things we do. We have metrics. Are they adding value? Are they creating value? Are we helping companies grow in the state? I mean, we have companies that we've started that started with zero employees and now they're at 30. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a very fast-growing, very high-tech business. So, I mean, in my mind, I mean, that's the other side of it. Our employees are not protected by any kind of agreements. It's all performance-based. If they're not doing their job, they won't have a job.
Gail Radford, I want to turn back to you, and you've studied these throughout history. Is this an issue? Is this an issue that comes up time and time again? This idea of how much money we're spending. The fact is that when you look at the books of quasi-governmental agencies or public authorities, sometimes you see very different numbers than you see in the public sector in terms of pay or even return on investment.
Well, I'd like to go back to a comment that Comptroller Lembo made after I had just kind of talked about the basics of these, and
yeah.
He mentioned that he said that perhaps what I was saying was that they should be administratively and financially independent of government, and what I was just describing what they are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the amount of independence that they have is actually quite problematic. The issue about that you raise about people having questions about salaries and various decisions, the problem, as I see it, is that these things are so fenced off from democratically accountable government that we as citizens, in many cases, can't make any input. These boards that are put in place, in some cases, I mean, officials that we vote for choose these boards, but in some cases, many cases, the boards can't be changed except if somebody does something illegal. I mean, they can't be changed if the public officials don't like what they're doing. They can raise money on their own, and so it just gives them so much independence, and they're unaccountable to us as voting citizens. So it's not, you know, this issue of high salaries. I mean, one of the reasons that people are motivated to set these things up is to get the kind of high-quality employees that Claire's operation obviously has. I mean, that sounds like a very well-run entity. But if we weren't so frugal about what we were willing to pay for people who worked in core government, democratically accountable government, then we might not have to resort in so many instances these workarounds.
Well, and it's interesting, and Kevin Lembo, as Gail's talking just now about this, the thing that I keep coming back to is that while we may be critical of the way quasi-governmental agencies work here in Connecticut or any place else, let's look at some of the other options. We've seen during previous administrations attempts at privatizing state services, literally handing them over to the private sector. People, rightly, have some questions about whether or not that's the right way to do things. People also say, look at the state contracts with workers. The fact is that over the course of time, we've gotten into some businesses at the public level that seemingly aren't able to be supported, that run deficits. We're not able to pay for all the health care and everything else over time. So with those two poles out there, this quasi-public thing in the middle that still has all these questions at least avoids the problems of both of those poles that we've certainly talked about and experienced here in Connecticut in the past.
It does and it doesn't. I mean, in some cases, we have salaries that are consistent with market salaries, depending on if you know how to run an airport or know how to run a venture capital firm or no. And then also participation in the state employee pension and health care program. Now, this may unleash sort of calls from your listeners and disagreement, but historically, the reason why that the pension and the health care benefits looked the way they did within state government is that they were a supplement to salary that was not quite sort of what it was in the private sector.
Exactly.
Here we have a health care and pension program that is attractive and also salaries that are attractive when the quasis participate in the and I'm gesticulating around here, but no one can see me. So that is a question.
You say when the quasi publics are part of this, the state health care
plan,
and they also pay the salaries that are commensurate with essentially being a private business.
Right. And we've had some quasis complain then about the administrative load of that participation. And you just want to say, you know, okay, you need to shut up now, because you know you're in this privileged place between two worlds, and in some cases enjoying the best of both worlds.
I want to get to a few quick phone calls before we go. Larry's calling from Hartford. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'd like to have at least addressed this unique animal called the Metropolitan District Commission, the Water Commission, which apparently is a municipality as well as quasi-public. We are having a devil of a time here in city government in Hartford with a few things. Let me just list them. One is transparency. Two is making sure that job allocation is fair in regard to minorities and women. Local hiring, as a public works project locally, it's been a failure in enhancing employment in this area. There was bonding questions which were not clear in the past, such that there's more borrowing. There are questions of regulation. Apparently it's not regulated as is CNG and CLP. The rates are just going through the roof for many of our citizens, not just in Hartford but surrounding, that drink their water. We had to pass state legislation to have them come under CHRO recently. So that there are all kinds of things in terms of the public interest and as a public works project where we are somewhat critical or suspicious of the MDC in terms of getting that information and control, enforcement, monitoring, and defending the citizens' interest and the ratepayers' interest, I would say, as well as taxpayers. I wonder if you can comment on this amalgamation of a quasi-public, quasi-municipality, which really has escaped public scrutiny and resists when city council tries to get information.
Well, and Larry, what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Kevin Lembo to comment on that, and thank you very much, just because we need to take a break soon. Go ahead, Kevin.
Not one of our state quasi-governmental, but very much present in our state life. Larry raises a number of very important points, and it really speaks to what is the oversight of these, whether they're state quasis or municipally focused quasi-governmental agencies. What is the oversight? Who's on the board? How did they get there? What hooks do you have into them? And how do you, as had been pointed out by Gail earlier, like how do you get them off there if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is to forward the public interest and to understand who their stakeholders are? Their employers, whether it's MDC or the health exchange, their employers are us. And, you know, there's got to be some accountability there.
And just in terms of transparency, I believe Larry is Larry Deutsch. He's a member of the Hartford City Council. Claire, did you want to jump in quickly?
I just want to talk. I just want to put out a word for our board, who is very active. I mean, they really put us through our paces, and we do strategic planning. They really press us on our budget. So, I'm sure all boards are different. But if I have a board member that isn't actively challenging me, I will go to the appointing authority and say, you know, this person isn't contributing. I'd really like to appoint someone different.
And not going down person by person, but who makes up the board of Connecticut Innovations? I mean, who would be appointed to that board?
Well, our board chair is Michael Cantor, who is a partner at Cantor Colburn. He is a very IP attorney, so very relevant. Catherine Smith, who's the DECD head, Christopher Swift, who's the CFO of the Hartford. There's a number of people, Rafael Santiago, who is an attorney as well. So we have a number of different people with different skill sets that really contribute to what we do.
And a board like the one at Connecticut Innovations would come together how, Kevin Lembo? I mean, how does it get appointed?
In the case of Connecticut Innovations, if memory serves, it's going to be four or five from the legislature and four or five from the governor's office, and then a couple of officers of the corporation that are
That's
also
right.
board members.
Ex officio.
Right.
We're going to try to answer some more questions about quasi-publics that you have for us at 860-275-7266. I want to thank Gail Radford, the author of The Rise of the Public Authority, State Building and Economic Development in 20th Century America. We'll continue with Claire Leonardi from Connecticut Innovations and State Comptroller Kevin Lembo. When we come back, we'll also hear from Abe Scar from ConPerg, and we'll be talking a little bit about Open Connecticut, this idea that Kevin Lembo has to try to give us more transparency about the dollars that we're spending at the state level. You can join us where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about quasi-public agencies, what exactly they are and how they work. In studio with us is State Comptroller Kevin Lembo. Claire Leonardi is with us as well at Connecticut Innovations Incorporated. She's the CEO there. We want to turn quickly in our last couple minutes here to Open Connecticut. Kevin Lembo put together this idea to try to make more transparent our government. What exactly is it, Kevin?
So it's a single spot where residents of Connecticut and others who are interested can go and find access to mostly financial data related to the state. So sort of agency budgets and HR stuff. And so we went around government and did the treasure hunt that citizens used to have to do to find all these pots of information, aggregated it all into one site, and then are building on that as we're moving forward. Recently, we launched a page that included all the quasi-governmental agencies, links to their most recent financial statements, a link to their homepage, so people could, you know, and follow up to this show, for example, go and find out what Connecticut Innovations, you know, is doing and who makes up their board and all of that. And now we are, for the last year, preparing for what I'm calling a forward-facing portal, which simply means creating a space where people outside of government can tap into real-time data, financial data of the state. So we would do a nightly download, a dump from the core financial system into this, we'll call it a sandbox, and then people can, through the webpage, go in and search by the criteria that they choose. We're almost ready, and it will give you more sort of what we call generally checkbook-level real-time data, and I think it's reasonable at some point to ask and wonder and debate whether some of that from the quasi-governmental agencies might be included in that as well.
I want to bring in Abe Scar, Director of Connecticut Public Interest Research Group, quickly, just to ask, given all these changes and these things that the state has instituted, how are we doing on transparency in government, Abe? What do you think?
I think Connecticut's doing well and improving. So 3 or 4 years ago, Connecticut had no transparency website, and compared to the rest of the state, the rest of the country, it was failing. And we've made great progress, and I want to compliment Comptroller Lembo on the work he's done. In our latest report we did last March that was comparing all of the state transparency efforts across the country, Connecticut actually fell a little bit behind because of the lack of economic development transparency data. And thanks to an executive order just in December from Governor Malloy, which Comptroller Lembo also worked a lot with his office on, we're now going to start seeing more of that data later this year. So we're definitely making strides, and we definitely believe that quasi-publics are an important part of that, and we need to start seeing more checkbook-level data on quasi-publics as we move forward.
And that's something, Kevin Lembo, you say that you're efforting. So when will that all happen? I mean, how much more still needs to be done in order to get that information?
Well, for the in-state piece of it, I think we're probably a couple of weeks. I don't want to put a date on it at this point. You know, they're still testing. You want to make sure anytime you open something like that, that you've got the proper security and the accuracy. When you look at organizations like the Yankee Institute, you know, that did that Sunshine CT site, they took it upon themselves to take a data dump from the state and put it into a digestible, searchable format for people to take a look at pensions and salaries and all of that are in the public domain and should be. I appreciate that effort. That's really not their role, though. You know, they went to great expense to do that. And in one of my first meetings after becoming comptroller, I said to the leadership there that it was my job to have them not have to do that anymore. Because it is our job to do it. And also, we can explain the information a little bit better because it's our data. It's the state's data that we administer. So in a couple of weeks, we'll be able to get the forward-facing portal going. And then, you know, with the governor's executive order, as Abe pointed out, is a huge step forward on the economic development transparency side.
And again, this is something we talk about a lot. This is the state investment in various ways in private corporations to stay in a town, to come to Connecticut in the first place.
That's right. And two big buckets. You know, one is the direct grants and forgiveness of taxes and all of that happens through the DECD. And then there's the tax expenditure side, the credits, and the other side of the balance sheet where people just don't pay taxes because they're performing a certain function or in a certain place. We need to figure out if we're getting the bang for our buck, and first step is transparency.
If you want to find out more about Open Connecticut or you want to find out more about Comperg's study about transparency, you can go to our website today. It's WNPR.org. I want to thank Abe Scar, director of the Connecticut Public Interest Research Group. I also want to thank State Comptroller Kevin Lembo. Very good to see you again. Thanks for coming
in. Good to see you, John.
And thanks to Claire Leonardi, who's the CEO of Connecticut Innovations Incorporated. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.